Joining us now is Len Greenwald, former constitutional civil rights litigator, currently contributing writer at Salon.com, the author of two New York Times best-selling books on the Bush administration's executive power and foreign policy abuses. He's just released a book with Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful, a scathing indictment of America's two-tiered system of justice. He's also the recipient of the first annual I.F. Stone Award for independent journalism. Thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing, Glenn Greenwald.
My pleasure.
And it's the, I guess if you go back to the beginning of this foundation of this country, which you do in the book, in terms of the founding fathers, they originally sort of envisioned the country, I guess, as a timocracy, the rule of those with property. But it's clearly evolved into more of a democracy. But it also seems to be at this point a democracy that coexists, albeit in a very awkward and uneven way with a oligarchy. So are we both a democracy and an oligarchy?
Well, I think the views of the founders on that question are somewhat complicated in the sense that they certainly believe that substantial income and wealth inequality would be not only inevitable but desirable. And, of course, that's not hard to understand, given that they were among the wealthiest individuals in that society. So they certainly wanted and admired a society that would produce large amounts of wealth inequality. There are a couple exceptions. Thomas Paine certainly viewed the wealthy as being sort of decadent, but in general, that's what they believed. But they were very clear about the fact that that inequality would be justifiable and legitimate only if it were grounded in a system under law where we were all bound by the same rules, so that the outcome inequality was justifiable and the byproduct of merit and what was deserved. And if, they virtually all argued, we abandoned that notion and allowed the wealthy to use their wealth to infect the legal and political system with severe amounts of inequality, then those outcome inequalities would be unjustifiable. So I think they envisioned a republic and a democracy, at least in terms of the principles that they espouse. They obviously violated them in lots of important ways, but in terms of the principles they espouse, I think that's what they have, that's what they envisioned and advocated. And I think what we have now is an oligarchy precisely because we've abandoned that vision, and we have allowed all of that wealth inequality to infect and shape the legal and political systems.
Well, it would seem that we have actually the worst of what Tom Paine railed against, which is counterfeit nobles, in the sense that the people on Wall Street are about extracting wealth, not creating wealth, and that they took the entire global economy into a near-death experience. They were bailed out by the taxpayer. They've been made whole. They have absolutely no gratitude. In fact, they seem to have contempt for the average people, in particular people demonstrating on the streets below them. And what they do seems to be kind of counterfeit.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, this is, you know, the Thomas Paine talked about, in contrast to counterfeit nobles, which is the aristocracy of Britain under the king, who were protected by their privileged legal status and were therefore counterfeit, and Paine heaped great scorn on them. He also talked about the natural aristocracy, people like Plato or Aristotle or Socrates, who achieved their high position through accomplishment and merit. And he was perfectly eager to accept the latter and not the former. And yet that would happen only if, as I said earlier, the legal system made a start on the same starting line, to use an analogy of a running race, and abide by the same rules so that whoever crossed the finish line first was really the fastest and deserved to win. And that's exactly what we don't have. And so you're right, we do have the worst of all worlds, and the reason for that is that the financial elites know that if they cheat and engage in pilfering and plundering and even commit massive fraud, as they did over the last decade, they will be shielded from all accountability and consequence. And when you tell them that, or when you tell political elites that they can commit crimes with pure impunity, what you're doing is you're guaranteeing that they will engage in criminal conduct because you've removed the deterrence against it.
So does that mean then, I want to get off the history, but does that mean, Glenn Greenwald, that we both have a oligarchy and a meritocracy, or that would seem to be mutually exclusive?
Well, I think we were intended to have a meritocracy, and we don't, and therefore we have an oligarchy. And what's interesting is, you know, just in terms of that distinction, you know, I think that there's been a lot of talk, for example, about what has motivated the extreme levels of citizen outrage against the political institutions and both parties and all political leaders and the like, or even the protest movements like we see with the Occupy protest movement. And for some time, there was a suggestion that this protest movement was about anger over large amounts of inequality. And I never thought that that was true, because we've had large amounts of inequality for several decades. It's been exploding for several decades. And I think Americans are basically inculcated to agree with and accept inequality if they believe it's justified and legitimate. So, for example, when Steve Jobs died, he died with $8 billion. And I don't think very many Americans begrudge that, even though the country was suffering from mass joblessness and foreclosures, because of a perception that it was deserved and that he earned it. But the perception now exists that the winners in this system are not people who abide by rules or who produce things for the common good, but are people who cheat and defraud and pilfer and then use their wealth to shield themselves from accountability. And therefore, these inequalities have become illegitimate. So it's not the mere existence of inequality that has led to all this anger and these protests, but the perception that it's illegitimate, that it's not grounded in meritocracy, but is instead an oligarchy ruled by the wealthy. And I think that's what's really spurring most of the unrest.
Again, I'm speaking with Glenn Greenwald, whose new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Glenn Greenwald, if the political energy is on the right, as the Tea Party indicated, and that was obviously a phony populist movement, an astroturf movement, if you will, that was guided by political pros like Karl Rove and Dick Armey, but they did that translated into 60 House seats. And they're working assiduously to win the next election, the Republicans. If the left abdicates, that doesn't that cede the entire field to the Republicans, and won't we have a one-party state in 2012?
Well, I guess there are a lot of people who believe that we have a one-party state, whether the Democrats or the Republicans win. So, for example, I was, you know, writing a great deal about things like warrantless eavesdropping and detention without charges and radical secrecy and presidential assertions of power to target people for death around the world without due process during the Bush years. And I remember very distinctly Democrats feigning anger over these things, and President Obama vowing to uproot them if he won. And then people, not just me, but many others, watched as the Democrats not only won the White House, but both houses of Congress. And these policies not only continued, but in many cases were strengthened and accelerated under a Democratic administration. I think the same thing happened on the domestic front, where President Obama vowed to change the way Washington works and to take the power away from the permanent factions who run Washington and reinvigorate the American people in terms of the way Washington responds to them. And then the first thing that he did was get into power and negotiate a health care bill in secret with lobbyists from those industries, or act to ensure that Wall Street and the securities industry boomed and thrived at exactly the same time that mass joblessness and foreclosures persisted and even grew. And so, you know, I think that one of the problems that the Democrats are having in terms of avoiding the situation that you just described and motivating their own voters the way Republican voters are motivated, is that they already convinced people in 2008 that if they worked and devoted their money and their time to electing a Democrat in the White House and in Congress, that things would be substantially different. And people did it and believed, and they put their cynicism to the side, and they saw that even though they won, that very little of that happened, and a lot of things got worse. And so there's a lot of cynicism and a lot of skepticism on the part of Democratic voters about whether or not it's even worthwhile to care, or whether or not their interest and their resources and energies are better devoted to working outside of the system rather than simply keeping the Democratic Party in power.
Again, I'm speaking with Glenn Greenwald, the author of the new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Well, at least one Democrat, Dick Durbin in the United States Senate, blurted out in 2009 that the Senate, that basically he said, frankly, the banks own the place.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, when you talk about the lesser of two evils, which has been the unfortunate choice that we've had mostly in this political duopoly for the longest time, you know, I mean, I don't want to waste time passing out who was the most evil of the evil, the lesser of the two evils. It does seem that one may be incompetent and have failed, but the other one seems to be quite malicious in terms of its war on working Americans and the middle class, wanting to take away what little we have left of a social safety net, Medicare and Social Security. And, you know, the other one, of course, is apparently all too ready to cede a lot of the ground that we've gained throughout these periods of oscillations between the power of the people and the power of the oligarchs. One of the starkest things in your book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, brings this out, and it sort of resonates with the 99% movement is the extent to which we have this shameful distinction of having more people in jail than any other country on the face of the earth, and a higher percentage of our citizens in jail than any other country on the face of the earth, and that includes some extremely unsavory regimes. The conversely, not one person has gone to jail for Wall Street. Do you think that there is any sympathy for the constituency where we warehouse generations of young men, particularly minority men?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's a growing sense that some of our criminal justice policies that are applied to ordinary Americans are at least counterproductive and to some extent even unfair and oppressive. We incarcerate people for offenses that are too trivial and minor to be met with prison terms in most Western countries around the world. We put them there for longer periods of time and with fewer options of relief and with less mercy than almost every Western country. A substantial part of that is the drug war, which I think Americans more and more, polls show, are coming to oppose, at least when it comes to things like marijuana. And that is, you know, once you start questioning putting people into prison for marijuana consumption or buying and selling, then the rest of the policy becomes called into question as well. And then there's an issue that we just can't afford it any longer. I mean, prisons eat up a huge part of state and local budgets. And what's amazing about it is that if you talk to somebody about why we put people into prison for the use of drugs, what they'll say is, well, because drugs destroy families and they destroy individual lives. And yet nothing destroys families and individual lives more than taking somebody with a drug problem and turning them into a criminal and taking them away from their families and putting them into a cage for a year or 5 years or 10 years and calling them a felon and preventing them from working. I mean, nothing is destroying our communities more than these oppressive penal policies. And so I think you do see a lot more questioning about these things than you ever did before. And the problem is that in America, we tend to have a very good versus evil, hero versus villain means of understanding political debates. And so once somebody is deemed to be a criminal, sort of like the way they're deemed to be a terrorist, we have this attitude, well, whatever happens to them is their own doing and we don't really care, and anything that's done to them is justifiable. And that is a very difficult bias to overcome in terms of getting people to understand why it's in the society's interest not to have this massive, sprawling, extremely expensive and oppressive penal state, but I think we do see some greater debate and attention being paid to it.
Well, one of the byproducts of this dysfunction in the war on drugs, of course, is that the country to the south, our neighbor Mexico, is essentially poised to become a failed state. It's so destabilized by the demand for drugs here in the United States, the denial that we have, we are part of the problem. It's actually our money that's fueling the mayhem in Mexico. And of course, because of our lax gun laws, weaponry flows down there unabated. So, do you think the wake up could come next door?
Well, what's so interesting about that is we learned these lessons before so clearly. I mean, you can almost find nobody who believes that returning to the era of prohibition in terms of alcohol is a good idea. I mean, people know that when you criminalized alcohol, you didn't really reduce the amount of alcohol consumption. What you did was drive it underground, and you created a huge industry of criminals and criminal gangs and mafia profits as a result of prohibition on alcohol. And that was why the country fairly quickly abandoned it. And yet exactly the same mistakes are being made now with prohibition of drugs. And, you know, one of the problems with all of these drug debates is, I mean, a big part of why there's so much violence in Mexico and now spilling over the border is precisely because we criminalize it and treat it as a war. And so the only people who are selling it are people who are criminals. And at the same time, the criminalization scheme keeps profits high, prices high, and therefore profits high. And it really is what fuels these cartels. And it's really in an irrational world. Concerns over violence in Mexico and the drug war in Mexico should be leading us to abandon criminalization schemes and the drug war. The problem is the more people perceive that there are problems associated with drugs, the more they support the drug war based on the false premise that the drug war decreases drug usage. And by the more we support the drug war, the worse these problems become. And it's just sort of this vicious cycle that needs to be broken if rational policies are to prevail.
Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Glenn Greenwald. So, Glenn Greenwald, you wrote the book With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Presumably, it's a kind of creed de coeur to get this country back on track and to restore a government of the people, by the people, for the people, and restore social justice, not to mention economic fairness. You spend a lot of time in Brazil, which is an emerging new power. Arguably, you know, we're in retreat. And there's nobody destroyed America's hegemony more than George W. Bush. And that 8-year reign of misrule has really reduced America's standing, both economically, politically, geopolitically, etc. Now, on the other hand, Brazil is on a roll. The Brazilians and the Chinese may end up having to bail out Europe so that they can keep their markets open. But it's not a country without social problems. What's the difference there? It seems to me that in the Brazilian culture and in terms of their national pride, there's a social contract in a sense that that things are getting it better and that there's a fairness out there. How would you, since you live in both countries, how would you describe and differentiate the two?
Well, it's really incredible. The two countries, Brazil and the United States, are about as opposite as can be in terms of the tracks that they're on. So, you know, if you went to Brazil 10 years ago, you saw a country that had an enormous rich-poor gap, a virtually non-existent middle class, a perception that the country was rife with corruption, pessimism about the future, contempt for their political class. And what you now have is the opposite. You have a booming middle class, amazing economic growth. The last president, Lula, left office with 84% approval. 84%, that's inconceivable in the United States. And they very much perceive of themselves accurately as a country that is rapidly on the rise and that is becoming more powerful, that has more prosperity, that their children will have extraordinarily more opportunity than they had. You can see the middle class having been created very quickly. And of course, in the United States, you have exactly the opposite perception. For the first time in our nation's history, huge numbers of Americans perceive that we are a nation on the decline. There is extreme levels of economic anxiety over the fact that our children will have less opportunity, will be poorer, will have harder lives than we've had, the exact reversal of the American dream. There's barely a middle class left. You're either extremely rich or working multiple jobs just to hang on and living paycheck to paycheck. And of course, Americans overwhelmingly hate their political class and believe that they're corrupt and ineffective. And a big part of the reason why is because the American system of government has been devoted to the interest of a small sliver of the country that has actually thrived at the expense of everybody else, whereas the Brazilian political system has been devoted to the opposite goal. They've been devoted to the goal of raising the opportunities and the prosperity for the vast majority of citizens and creating opportunities where none existed and prosperity where it was unimaginable to see it. And they're really two countries on completely opposite tracks for that reason.
So, Glenn Greenwald, what do you hope? Because we're offering up your book here in support of our radio station of this program with Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. What do you hope? We've talked about the broader kind of zeitgeist where there's this nascent movement to take back America that's spontaneously erupted on Wall Street and spread across the country and around the world. I was just yesterday in a small town in Northern California, Petaluma, just driving through the main street, and there on the corner there was about 200 people with signs, "Down with greed." I mean, it was an extraordinary sight to see in small town America this sense of outrage. And this was a cross section of people. This wasn't anybody's, or particularly Fox News's idea of the usual suspects.
Right.
Give us a sense of what you feel the why you wrote the book. That in simple terms, why did you write the book?
I think the key to generating meaningful political change is to communicate the realities of political life in the country to one's fellow citizens and to try and motivate them to care more and to act. And I really, do believe that there is this inchoate sense that what is truly fundamentally wrong with our political culture, first and foremost, is that we no longer play by the same set of rules, that we don't really have a democracy, that if you are wealthy and powerful, the entire system is devoted to your interest to the point where you can even literally exempt yourself from the one area where we were supposed to have complete equality, and that's the law. And that has delegitimized all other forms of political life, and it's really destroyed the opportunity that has long been the hallmark of American life, the idea that if you work hard and achieve and produce, then you can improve your state and you'll have basic security. That's no longer the case. One of the things that you're able to do when you write a book is to take a step back from the normal day-to-day political debates and to devote a lot of thought and do a lot of research and try and highlight what the real causes are, what the real root problem is. The only reason for me to write a book, the only reason that I would ever write a book, is because I believe that there are important things that need to be said that aren't being said, and the book is an opportunity to say them. And the reason why one wants to say them is to tell one's fellow citizens, there are these severe and profound injustices that you don't have to accept and shouldn't accept. And there are movements right now underway. The Middle East taught this lesson, but we're teaching it to ourselves that even the most seemingly invulnerable power factions that are created by human beings can be replaced and torn down by other human beings if the will is there. And there's certainly a lot of reason to try, and there's lots of reason to think we can succeed. And, my writing this book was just my trying to play my part in helping that bring that about.
And Glenn Greenwald, we spoke earlier of the dubious distinction of having more people in jail than any other country, both in terms of the number and in terms of the in ratio to our population, and obviously to some extent that population is in jail for economic crimes, and as much as they can't get a job, and the jobs that are available may be associated with the crime, but just back to the 1% and the financial elite, The 2008 crash was a huge scam that was a Robin Hood in reverse, where they attracted a bunch of aspirants to the middle class, mostly minority people, to buy homes on fraudulent basis with traps in the small print. They ended up reaping enormous amounts of money, creating this bubble. Some of the smart people like Paulson, a hedge fund guy, bet against it. In other words, he bet that people would be kicked out of their homes and would have to be forced to live in their cars. That's the callousness on the part of the financial elite and how they've been reaped this enormous profits in this kind of Robin Hood in reverse. But if you use the law as a weapon to create more penury, I don't believe that we'll ever get back to debtor's prison. But in effect, I just heard on the radio today that the various states in this country, including the state of Idaho, apparently have laws now that if your house is foreclosed on, you can't walk away, that you in fact are indebted. And you have to pay that off, and that they're going after people, and the banks are even selling these debts to kind of collection agencies. So do you think that there's a possibility that the capture of the law by the elite, who don't abide by any kind of moral principles that are recognizable, but can get away whether they can get away with murder, I'm not sure, but they can sort of get away with theft. What about the notion that they will shackle us with the detritus of their own wreckage?
I mean, that's the, you know, this is the main problem, is that when you have the ability of elites to shield themselves from the law and only everyone else is subjected to it, that law ceases to become a guarantor of equality, and it becomes a weapon in the hands of the powerful to maintain social control and entrench their own power. And you see this in all kinds of ways. You see people who are in power who commit serious crimes being exempt from consequences, and yet the Obama administration is waging a vast war on whistleblowers. People who expose government wrongdoing and improprieties being prosecuted with great vengeance. Or you see Wall Street criminals who have suffered no investigations or consequences for their massive theft, and yet at the same time the law has changed, so special courts are created to make foreclosures much, much easier to finalize and take away people's homes. And this is really using law as exactly the opposite of what it was intended to be, which is a weapon in the hands of those who are most powerful. And, you know, there's an interesting article by Simon Johnson, who is the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, in 2009 in The Atlantic. And one of the reasons it's interesting is because it used to be that the kind of conversation that you and I are having would be confined to sort of the radical and fringe realms of dissent. I mean, the idea of talking about the United States as an oligarchy or as a lawless state would be something that most people would sort of recoil at. And yet now it's so glaring that it has entered into mainstream discourse. So we can read in the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof, a columnist there, routinely describing America as a banana republic or a third world country, and he should know since he travels around the world all the time in those countries. And Simon Johnson wrote this article, even though he's the former chief economist of the IMF, as mainstream a position as it gets, and it was called The Quiet Coup. And the word coup in his article refers to the fact that the nation's elite, financial elite, have taken over control of the United States. And what he said is that in his experience at the IMF, he worked on financial crises and collapses in emerging market governments in developing countries like Argentina and Russia immediately after the fall of communism, and in Eastern European states and other South American states. And he said that what would happen there is that whenever there was a financial collapse caused by the corruption of elites, those financial elites would use their control over the government to make sure that the government acted to protect them, the ones who caused the crisis, at the expense of everybody else, and taking as much as possible from the average citizen to protect the elites and shield their interests from harm. And he said this goes on until essentially people in the streets decide that they're no longer willing to tolerate it. And that is exactly, he says, what has happened in the United States, that the use of their control over law and politics has meant that they shield themselves and protect their own interests at the expense of everybody else's and saddle us with their burden and with their debt. And I think that's exactly what you see in the United States. And it's acknowledged not just by people like us, but in the most people who have spent their lives working in the most mainstream institutions.
So just in closing then, Glenn Greenwald, do you think that we've already discussed the notion that there is some kind of backlash underway. We're not quite sure where it's heading, but we know what it's in response to. Just looking at the faces that were demonstrating yesterday in the small town that I drove through, the idea that average Americans are outraged by this sense of betrayal to the kind of mythology of that we're a meritocracy and an egalitarian society, and that things just aren't fair anymore. So do you think that the wedge issue here is fairness?
I really do. I actually wrote an article last week in which I made the argument that what I believe is motivating the Occupy movement specifically in citizen anger generally is not that Americans have suddenly rejected the virtue or desirability of wealth inequality. I think Americans are sufficiently inculcated, for better or worse, to believe that wealth inequality is something that's justifiable as long as it's fair. I think that what's motivating it is the sense that it no longer is fair, that the people against whom they're protesting are not simply wealthy, but are cheaters, thieves. And that the politicians who are there to safeguard against that robbery are themselves captive to those same interests, if not as corrupt. And that it is the fact that the winners don't deserve their winnings, not that winning in general is illegitimate or wrong. And you see this, you know, this sense on the right, and you see it on the left, and you see it in across the spectrum. And I think a big part of it comes from the fact that Americans watched Wall Street tycoons engage in all kinds of oozing illegality and corruption, and not a single one of them have seen the inside of a courtroom. And that really was a triggering moment, signaling to Americans on whose behalf our government really works, and the mythology, as you called it, that we're in any way subjected to the same set of rules on a roughly equal basis.
Well, Glenn Greenwald, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Glenn Greenwald, who's a former constitutional and civil rights litigator and currently contributing writer at Salon.com. He's the author of two New York Times best-selling books on the Bush administration, executive power, and foreign policy abuses. His just-released book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful, is a scathing indictment of America's two-tiered system of justice. He is the recipient of the first annual I.F. Stone Award for Independent Journalism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.